Hello and welcome to our podcast, Charting the Australian Fantastic, where we discuss all the new Australian speculative fiction. You are about to listen to one of our newer episodes since we finally caught up with our archive. So enjoy the episode about to start and stay speculative.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of our lovely podcast. Today we're going to be discussing Thylacines by Deborah Sheldon. I am joined, of course, as always, by my co-host, Dr. Burger, and I'm also joined by our research assistant, Theodora. So if you guys want to introduce yourselves or your voices, at least you can drop that in now.
Sure. I am Dr. Burger. I'm Tina, Dr. T. All names acceptable.
Hi, everyone. It's lovely to be here.
All right. So let's get right into this text. Before we dissect some of the specific details, because we're going to be talking about the cultural importance of the Thylacine and all of this sort of stuff, de-extinction, monster theory, I think it would be good if we had some idea of what the heck the book's about for anybody who doesn't know. So could one of you drop a summary?
So the novella Thylacines is set in a research facility that is, I think, called the De-Extinction Lab or something along those lines. The name really says what they're doing. They're trying to de-extinct the thylacine, and they have succeeded in creating a pack of them, but something's off. And so when their sponsors come in and they're trying to make a good impression because they want to have funding for their research, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners, and especially Lucas and I, are very familiar with. It's a very nerve-wracking experience. So they want to get their funding, but things go massively wrong. First, the facility is hijacked by environmentalists and the thylacines get loose, and then it becomes a kind of creature feature. We have these monstrous beings chomping on all the characters, and that's basically the gist of it.
So I think in order to unpack really what the text is about, we also might need to have a better idea of what thylacines actually are. I think they're also called the Tasmanian tiger or something, if I'm not mistaken. Perhaps one of you can weigh in a bit.
Thylacines, I think the term is the scientific term for the Tasmanian tiger. They are dog-like marsupial mammals that have originated in Australia that went extinct due to the white settlers. They were hunting them down, and they were deemed very dangerous despite them actually not being dangerous.
The interesting thing is that, well, it's called the Tasmanian tiger because when white settlers came there, they were only present on Tasmania and not on mainland Australia, but they used to be there. They went extinct, I think, maybe 3,000 years ago, maybe a bit more. We do have rock paintings by Aboriginal Australians that depict thylacines. So there was already a previous extinction. And then, as you said, the ones on Tasmania also became extinct due to hunting, due to how the white settlers reacted to this predator that was there. And the name, I guess, gives you already an idea how they were perceived as the Tasmanian tiger or the Tasmanian wolf. And so it was perceived as this predator that was dangerous to people, to livestock, but they really weren't. The book that we're going to talk about frequently says that the original thylacines were as dangerous as a lamb, so not very much.
I know that the thylacine is culturally significant to Australia. Could we kind of explain or touch on that a little bit as well?
Absolutely. So it's become a kind of figurehead for extinction, for human-made extinction. And as such, it has taken on this cultural significance of being the original sin of extinction that still haunts Australia. So that's why it comes up again and again in popular culture. It's featured in the crests of Tasmania. It's featured on the car signs, license plates. And there are stories like the one in thylacines where they are de-extincted, and there's actual talk about doing this. There are people who are looking at the genome and trying to get a new thylacine. So this is based in actual reality. You can find articles online where people are talking about these science projects. And I think one of the largest funding organizations is actually supported by Chris Hemsworth, out of all people. And so we have the Thylacines in this novel. There are a couple of other novels. Julia Lay's The Hunter talks about hunting the last remaining thylacine, not in the 1930s when it's said to have died out, but later. So there's rumors of thylacines persisting, and in The Hunter, the eponymous hunter goes and kills that thylacine. And there are actually rumors still in both Tasmania and Australia. There are people who say, oh, I've seen a thylacine. They are still around. And a recent study came out saying that, well, maybe they were around until the early 2000s.
Fascinating. So when it comes to their specific kind of cultural location, I guess they are connected to this idea of a kind of extinction that moves beyond the human, right? Because we often might associate some of the kind of discourse around Australia and even Tasmania, even in existing novels, like the beginning of War of the Worlds, I think, talks about making Aboriginal Tasmanians extinct as a consequence of the British Empire. So there is this kind of cluster, I guess, all around the thylacine that connects to this idea of animal extinction caused by humans that isn't tied specifically to, for instance, climate change. So it opens up kind of a whole different kind of discussion about extinction, de-extinction, and the ethical consequences thereof. It also makes me think of James Bradley's Ghost Species, which similarly tries to de-extinct different animals. Of course, the eponymous ghost species as well of the non-Homo sapien predecessors, right, of the Neanderthalus. That said, I think maybe we should talk about this de-extinction in the novel. Obviously, we start later into the project, right? We don't start at the beginning of the project. So we begin with the thylacines already having been made de-extinct, but they are very different, as Tina has explained. How are they different?
They are portrayed later in the story, especially to have characteristics of kangaroos. They are a lot bigger than the original thylacines, and definitely a lot smarter, conniving, and extremely dangerous.
Yeah, the kangaroo thing, that might not be so different, because early sightings and descriptions, they did say that the thylacine could hop like a kangaroo, but the other things definitely, like they're giants and they're vicious. They're almost monstrous.
I'm also referring to one of the thylacines trying to strangle Glenn in the story, which is something that a lot of kangaroos do when they're trying to defend their territories. The jumping is also a factor, though I don't know about this. You can fact check me. In the story, using the hind legs to jump very high alongside the tail seems more extreme than hopping would be.
Yeah, definitely. I think you've got a point there. There's a scene where one of them jumps like 6 feet high. And there's also scenes where they're standing on their hind legs and towering over the people. And I think aside from making them more monstrous and less like actual thylacines, it also speaks to how strange these animals were also to the original white settlers, because they look like a canine, like a dog, like a wolf, maybe like a tiger, not a canine, but you know, that kind of four-legged predator. But they act very, very differently. They act very differently, certainly in the novel, and that adds maybe a level of the uncanny. It's like it looks like something that should be familiar. It looks like a dog, could be your pet, could be our lovely Bean, but it isn't.
And of course, I think in the novel, they exhibit a strong level of intelligence, as has been stated. But to give an example, they are capable of setting traps. They're capable of kind of understanding the need to escape, things that maybe we wouldn't associate with animals as far as intelligence or sapience is concerned, right? We would maybe think of these as like instinctual drives. Mm-hmm. But the actual thylacines in this novel have basically no instinctual drives that are outside of the ones that have been somehow miraculously cultivated by de-extinction. So it's very strange, because It begs the question of what an instinct could be, or like what is an animal instinct? And they don't have the kind of nurturing from thylacine parents to know like proper thylacine behavior. So there's kind of a suggestion that maybe Glenn, as their like teacher, is somehow imparting like human knowledge or human behaviors onto the thylacines, because he is trapping them, for instance, and so on and so forth.
That's interesting. Maybe. There's a scene very early on where they all act the same despite being separated in their separate cages. They can't see each other. And the main researcher, I think Professor Rosie Giuliani, she asks Glenn, well, how do they know to do that? They can't see each other. And Glenn says, I think it's language. And that's interesting, to have these animals, and Glenn attributes language to them. And of course, we know now that animals do communicate in a kind of language of their own, but it seems to be almost human-like. And Rosie then you know, asks, oh, but they didn't learn from their thylacine mother how to vocalize. How can it be? It's almost like telepathy. And I think that adds like a level of eeriness to the story. There might be something even supernatural going on. You know, what they really remind me of are the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, because they are also portrayed as these super intelligent pack animals setting traps, communicating, opening doors. And I think, you know, there's something to be said about this de-extinction relating back to Jurassic Park.
I mean, I guess we are, you know, we are literary scholars, so I don't know where we can weigh in when it comes to questions of de-extinction, but I can't help but ask anyway, you know, what do we actually think of the way that de-extinction is carried out in this novel, but also, like, the ethical ramifications, because this is obviously a kind of warning against pursuing these ends.
I mean, ethics has been mentioned a couple of times within the novella as well, particularly the way the experiments have been taking place and the process of de-extinction. Glenn, especially when he first joined the project, he was very concerned about how these animals are being de-extinct and how many of them must first die until the scientists manage to get, in quotations, proper batch of them. And I say it in that way because they are treated less than an animal, but rather an experiment.
Yeah, like we talked about this earlier before we were recording, how most of the people involved in the experiments are calling them by numbers, like T1, T2, and so on, and are treating them like, well, not like animals. But then there's Glenn, their handler, who has given them all names. And we talked about how he's kind of, yeah, he's ambiguous. We don't really know what to make of him.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about the character of Glenn, because although he does seem to care a lot more about the thylacines as animals in general, he's the only one that named them, giving them some sort of agency. He also refused to sedate them during the visit from their sponsors. In a way, it felt as if he was fetishizing the idea of the thylacine because of how he responded, saying, oh, we need to show the greatness of this fantastic animal. And I wasn't really sure how to feel about that.
It's certainly highlighting the spectacle of them.
It also makes me think about funding, about how we need to, as scientists, as researchers, as workers in the academy, how we need to show off the biggest thing. And I can't help but think that maybe Glenn's desire to save the project, to save these kind of this batch of surrogate children or something, might also be part of his motivation, right? It's definitely ambivalent and unclear, but I think the novella in general is arguing kind of against de-extinction, right? It does so by also mobilizing, for instance, a kind of secondary protagonist in Janine O'Connell, the Irish policewoman, Irish heritage policewoman, I should say, with canine units. And it very much upholds the kind of state authority, right? Like, if the state had been aware of the deconstruction, the de-extinction, rather, project to its full, they might have intervened or stopped these things. It's the evil corporations and the researchers who only care about money that seem to cause the key problems in the novel. And I personally take a bit of issue with that, but I'm curious about your kinds of thoughts.
It's definitely a very interesting take. For me, I didn't really think about the policewoman taking that role, but the facility, their motivations did seem very ambivalent as well. Mm. We are not very sure if they're actually wanting to de-extinct these animals in order to take maybe responsibility of the past, or if they're doing it for the press, if for the name, the money that the facility can get.
There's definitely a hint of them being in it for the money in mm-hmm. some extent, though I think we all know they're not going to get rich at the university. But at the beginning, they're talking about how they need to impress their new sponsors. The new sponsors are, I think, an energy drink corporation from North America called Cloud. And the previous ones were called Dinkum Ale Beers and were like a very quintessentially Australian company. So we have this difference already. And they talk about how Cloud, the new organization, the new company, they've already cut funding to a program that meant to save an endangered frog species. So that was a program that was trying to help a species that is still around. So actual like conservation efforts. And then Rosie, the professor, she says, oh, but you know, who cares about frogs? We've got thylacines. People care about thylacines. So that's highlighted a lot.
There's a kind of capitalist, like anti-capitalist bent, but it's like reserved within this kind of Australian pure culture being depicted by the novella, right? It's an American corporation that comes to stop the good Australians from rehabilitating species and helping endangered species. And we don't really get much criticism of like the Australians' perspectives, I guess, on these thylacines, for instance, on the glorification of these animals. It's rather like that things have got out of hand or they weren't mm-hmm. under proper control, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. Like the previous company, Dinkum, that's an Australian slang, I guess, word meaning genuine, honest. So that plays to what you just said, like this honest, down-to-earth Australian perspectives. But then you already said that we are halfway through the project already when the novel starts, the novella. These animals have already been de-extincted. These thylacines are around. So I wonder whether that's not maybe subtly saying, okay, but even though the company Dinkum is called Dinkum and is so down to earth, they are the ones who funded the initial experiment.
I mean, it's a good point. Either way, there's some kind of attention really being shifted towards clout, right? About maybe focusing on kind of projects that maybe don't actually help the planet in any unique or particular way. Like, I don't know if bringing back the thylacines will really do all that much. Whereas maybe conservation efforts that would have helped the frogs that do exist and maybe help their habitats or something might have a greater impact, right? Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a kind of focus on these bigger, flashier mm-hmm. events. But maybe that's also why they need to be punished by the thylacines.
Yeah, maybe. We also have the component of the environmentalists, like the environmentalist terrorists that break into the facility and kind of cause the eventual punishment. But they're also very interestingly portrayed, the environmentalists. What do you think?
Oh, definitely. They don't seem to know what they're getting into.
One of them is, of course, the daughter of the actual, like, clout representative or something. He's like a Dutch national person. Another person is a...
I think they're friends of the daughter, and that's how...
Oh, friends of the daughter.
That's how the environmentalists know what's going on, because he blabbed. But I think the daughter isn't there.
Sorry, friends of the daughter. Major correction. Apologies. But they're connected rather directly to the corporation through this daughter and friend. And then there's like the true kind of environmental terrorist, the kind of almost incel-ish character who's I don't know, supposedly representing far left kind of political values, doesn't really believe in certain kinds of behavior, and then he's allied with these kind of new age leftists, progressivists who are pacifists and vegans and are more inclined to free the Thylacines than do anything else. And it's all very, to me, it comes off as a very disingenuous characterization of leftist politics. But I don't know what you guys think of it.
I would agree, and I also think this incelish person, I think he's called George, he's also in it for the clout, right?
Yeah, he is.
Like he's definitely contrasted to the more earnest but naive Hannah, who's one of the friends. In that he constantly thinks about how this other guy, Llewellyn, he was in the newspaper for his protesting, and George wasn't, and that seems to bother him quite a lot. So I think I agree that this is like a disingenuous portrayal of them.
Sorry if you heard that our little Thylacine is making some noise in this room.
Yeah, I do think the one person that does come off as the most genuine one in their pursuit to free the Thylacines is Hannah. None of them seem quite bright in general in the novel, so I would agree with everything that's being said. And they are definitely not very well informed about the project itself. One of the two boys, he does say, "Oh, I'm trying to save animals. What are you doing? Eating them?" And that's definitely not what they were doing with the Thylacines. So yeah, their motives are very questionable, as well as they're very ignorant.
Like they're naive. They're not. They're very,
There is, of course, also this tendency for them not to listen to the scientists, and that's something we see kind of reflected in business doesn't listen to the scientists, the activists don't listen to the scientists. Who's listening to the scientists in this story, right?
The scientists.
Only the scientists.
Not even Glenn.
Yeah, not even Glenn.
Oh, true, yeah. He's depicted as going against them all the time, and the policewoman that you mentioned earlier, she doesn't even believe that that's actually happening. Like when she's told, okay, Tasmanian tigers, they've escaped, she, I think, says, bullshit, Tasmanian tigers aren't around. You talked about the policewoman as a representative of order, of the status quo, of the government control. And I just happened upon a scene with her where she goes with her dog, who is a German shepherd, and who she instructs using German terms, which is so weird. Like, why, just because he's a German shepherd, like you don't have to raise him with German terms.
In the novella, they say that it's because of the fact that then they can't be mistaken for like English words and things like
right.
this, because people aren't just shouting German. In Australia, it does happen here. As we are located in Germany, but
yeah, I forgot about that. But that's still interesting, right?
Yeah, it is, because like, it evokes. Obviously, it could have been not a German shepherd. It could have been something that wasn't associated, maybe so blatantly, with policing as a kind of fascist object.
Absolutely. Now, actually, I just found a scene where it says it avoided confusion. But imagining this police officer just going around Australia shouting in German, it's a certain aesthetic that I think we're all familiar with, and that's worrying. At one point, she asks her dog if he's fine, if he's unharmed. And the way she says this is Heil. And that's an odd choice of words. I don't know if it's deliberate and you know, making this association between the police force and, well, Nazis, but maybe.
I think it's also just a stereotype, at least in other countries, in the one I grew up in, at least Cyprus. There is this idea that German dog training is the best, which is very interesting, and a lot of people either train their dogs in Germany, or they hire German trainers to train their dogs, as well as with the canine being a German shepherd. That is the most stereotypical breed of dog to be
in
the police companion.
Mm. Yeah, that's so interesting. I had no idea about this German stereotype, so it's great that we have that.
It's true. I think now, because we are quite it looks like we probably have reached quite a bit far into the podcast. I still want us to talk about the monsterization, the monstrification, however we're going to say that, of the Thylacines, and we might occasionally lean on Jeffrey Jerome Cohen's monster theses, the 7 most popular theses in literary studies, perhaps. What do we have to say about the Thylacine in and as a monster?
I think on the level of the the story, the novella, it's definitely a monster horror, animal horror, monster horror. It's a creature feature. So we have this popular culture element. But I do think we can see all the other dimensions as well. The first thesis says the monster's body is a cultural body. And we talked about the cultural significance of the Thylacine already.
I think the second thesis, the monster always escapes, is obviously reflected in the escape of the final Thylacine into the woods. There's a kind of expectation that maybe that Thylacine will somehow continue its horror or come back, or maybe it will just die, but of course it won't. We all know better. As scholars, how we read this idea of the monster escaping is that the real horror or the real threats behind the Thylacine does not escape. So in a way, even the survival of some of the scientists reflects that the monster always escapes in this case.
Yeah, there's often the allusion to Frankenstein in the novel. And of course, Frankenstein is often in popular culture confused with Frankenstein's monster. So maybe that opens up the question, who's the real monster? Is it the Thylacines or is it the scientists who made them?
And of course, the correct answer is it's Glenn, right? Because he does not sedate these dangerous creatures. He ignores the advice of the scientists. There is, of course, a question of, do we blame the weapons manufacturers for the acts of the weapon? And similarly, do we blame the monster creators for the acts of the monster? Maybe we should. And it is worth considering. I totally agree.
It's also interesting because everyone is to blame. Everyone has done something wrong. If the project was not continued once they saw that the Thylacines were not actually Thylacines, they were this hybrid Thylacine monster, then crisis would have been averted if Glenn decided to listen to the scientists and actually sedate them. This would have not happened. If the sponsor didn't talk about the project with his family, the activist wouldn't have known about it. And also, if the activist were more knowledgeable about the project and also have listened to the scientists telling them these are not harmless creatures, again, this would have never happened. So it's definitely everybody's fault. Everybody had contributed to this mess that was created.
What is telling is this concept of collective responsibility. So it's not any specific person that is seemingly ascribed with the issue, in part because, as you say, they establish a bunch of fault points where things could have gone differently. They could have even done better if someone simply had known there was a bullet in a gun. Or, had proper trigger discipline and things like this. There's so many different small moments that create this problem. And this fits rather well with the idea of the kind of crises we see that open up from categories, right, that are caused by the monster. In this case, we have the categories of for instance, nature and artifice, the hybrid Thylacine animal monster. How do we categorize this monster, right? Mm-hmm. And when we explore those kind of rigid boundaries that seemingly are rigid, we realize just how porous they are through the monster. And we also can see that this really evokes some of the fundamental problems with maybe science in Australia or regulation in Australia, in corporations in Australia, in activism in Australia, although I might disagree with that last one.
It's also interesting that it's never explained why the Thylacines become these monsters. You both use the word hybrid, but it's not really a hybrid in a genetic sense, because they use the dead Thylacine pup pickled in alcohol to extract the DNA. In Jurassic Park, it's explained that the dinosaurs are different from actual dinosaurs because different DNAs strands where we're introduced to the genome because it was incomplete. So that's not happening here. So we might wonder, why does this happen? It could be like a punishment, almost. Or it could be like the artifice coming in that's doing this.
I think there is, though, a kind of understanding that they're a hybrid figure because of the mothering creature, right?
Mm.
Because they are not using a thylacine mom to bear the thylacine children. So there's already a kind of false mother. And this is also a very common horror trope that we see played out in Frankenstein. A lot of people say that, I shouldn't say a lot of people, but literary scholars say, probably much less than a lot of people, that part of the horror that is evoked in Frankenstein is the kind of desire for this male scientific figure to have a child, to be able to have a womb and produce a child, this kind of forbidden male motherhood or something. And I think this is partially evoked by this sort of de-extinction process. And it also connects to that thesis about desire. So I'm wondering if we could talk about, you know, what kind of desires are manifested by the thylacine.
Before that, I actually just wanted to add...
Go ahead, sorry.
The thylacine as a monster is very fascinating to me. We also talked about hybridity in that sense, but the thylacine in the novella doesn't just feel as if it's a monstrous dog kind of creature, but in reality it also feels a lot like a ghost figure because of the sightings that have allegedly happened and keep happening. It has become almost an urban legend. I personally didn't know that it was an actual animal. The lack of photos of the thylacine, the whole mystery surrounding it, I came into Tina's course where we talked about this, thinking that it was an urban legend until very late into the course I realized that, oh, this actually existed. And it definitely does create this hybrid monster in a way as well, of this dog-like creature as well as this ghost figure that exists but also doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think I made you research the thylacine for an illustration as well. And I was really hoping, and you delivered perfectly. You're welcome. For it to be almost like a cryptid sighting. And that's what they've become. Of course, they were real creatures. We've got videotapes from the 1930s. But the way they are described now, it's people are seeing them dash across the road. We've got very blurry videos similar to those that we have of Nessie. So it has become a cryptid creature in that way. And I also thought it was very interesting that you called them ghosts, because we will be writing about eco-ghosts in the very near future. So I think Lucas and I would agree that they are kind of haunting presence.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about the ghost thing. I would love to unpack that more. We definitely don't have time to do that on the podcast, though. So I think we need to redirect ourselves, march on through the theses a bit more. So I was trying to set us up to talk about desire and what kind of desire the thylacine might evoke. What comes to mind?
I think it's partly the desire for redemption. This extends beyond the novel. It's the hope to bring this animal back from extinction because we are at fault that it's dead in the first place. So it's the hope of bringing the animal back, this redeem ourselves and kind of undoing what has been done in the past. And that has also been discussed very critically as this will stop us from caring about extinction. This will stop us from trying to save these animals. And this, I think this is fairly explicit in the novel with the frog versus the thylacine. And different writers, like, for example, the Aboriginal writer Jasper Wild, has had a different take on the de-extinction of the thylacine, because in his short story Thylacine, he talks about also a de-extinction project and how these animals then weren't the real thylacines either, and he is visited by the ghosts of the actual thylacine. So that's an interesting cultural, literary cluster, I think.
I mean, I don't have anything to add there. I would definitely agree that I think it's this novella on a subtextual level, is about redemption as well. And it's about people trying to find different kinds of redemption, even through their acts of trying to stop the Thylacines. This is a kind of act of redemption for science gone too far or something like this.
Yeah, that relates back to the fifth thesis, the monster polices the borders of the possible. So if science goes too far, it has crossed the border, and thus the monster comes into existence.
100% agree, and what the novella does very nicely is also showing that human interference in both cases leads to consequences. Bringing them back also has consequences. Having a creature that is not quite the same that will inevitably cause harm. And I think that's a very interesting message to send, especially knowing that there are facilities that are trying to do that. It's not just fiction like Jurassic Park. It's something that it is happening.
I mean, it hasn't happened yet. I should say to our listeners who are maybe worried. They are research projects that hope to de-extinct the Thylacine, but just like with the dinosaurs, hasn't happened yet. Unlike the dinosaurs, we do have a complete genome of the Thylacine by now, so it's definitely more in the realms of the possible than with the dinosaurs, unfortunately.
But of course, whether you love your dinosaur islands or your Thylacine islands, I think it might be time for us to wrap it up, come to a close. So any last thoughts?
Well, I guess I think it's an interesting look at a cultural figure, and it shows us really how a fairly thin novella that is definitely in the genre of animal horror, a creature feature, can still have a lot of layers that we can talk about and speak to important cultural conversations about the Thylacine, the hope for redemption, de-extinction, and so on.
And especially since the Thylacine is not an animal that it's well known, I think, outside of Australia, it's very nice having some sort of representation, even if it's maybe a bad one. But it does bring back into discussion the colonization of Australia and the
environmental consequences, maybe.
Mm. Yes, thank you.
And I think when you say a bad representation, it's more about how they are monstrous, not how it's...
Yes, of course. Of course.
I guess my last thoughts would be to, you know, draw a comparison. I think it's definitely interesting. We have The Roo by Alan Baxter and Thylacines by Deborah Sheldon that both explore kind of iconic Australian monsters as creature features, as Tina has noted. And I think it would be really cool to kind of look at these and maybe even other horror novels, animal horror novels. Maybe there's some that haven't even been written yet that maybe explore koalas. I don't know.
I'm sure that if there aren't any, there will be, because we have the drop bear as well. So, yes. Mm-hmm.
In any case, thank you very much for listening. And I hope that you stay speculative, I believe.
This has been one of our podcast episodes. We welcome and encourage you to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or on our YouTube channel, or indeed all of the above. We would also be very happy if you could review us on your podcast service if you can. You can find all these details in the description. If you're interested in being a guest on our podcast, just drop us an email. And don't forget, stay speculative.